you get at the surface a line of volcanoes, which you can see, if you remember this is a cross section, look at the diagram, is going to be parallel to the subduction trench, but displaced from it in the direction of subduction. You got that? So you typically tend to have a subduction trench, a deep ocean trench, and a line of volcanoes that is parallel to it. Those volcanoes are made of a rock that is not basalt, it's only the low melting lightweight fraction of basalt, and that kind of rock is called andesite. It is named for the Andes Mountains. Going back to the other map, you will see what happens there. If the subduction zone is the basaltic plate going under a granitic plate, then the line of volcanoes is going to pop up in the edge of the granitic plate. And that is the reason for the volcanoes in the Andes, from which andesite gets its name, and that is also the reason for the Cascades, as a result of this subduction there from that little bit of spreading ridge whose eastern edge is called the Gorda Plate. On the other hand, suppose it's a basalt plate being subducted under a basalt plate. Then the volcanoes come up, the volcanic material comes up, right in the middle of the ocean. And so you have a line of volcanic islands in the middle of the ocean. And now you know why New Zealand is there, why the Philippines are there, why Japan exists, why the Aleutian Islands exist, why the American Indies exist over there at the edge of this Caribbean plate, this little mini plate over there, and this line of islands, the South something or others down there at that subduction zone, and Indonesia is a result of this process, and so forth. Those are andesitic volcanoes produced by partial melting, by the low melting point fraction of the material that is being subducted. Okay, but you say, gee, as it gets farther down, surely the high melting fraction begins to melt over there. Why doesn't it too bob to the surface? Can you tell me why? The high melting fraction is also the heavy fraction. It stays where it is, it gets melted back, rejoins the asthenosphere, and so there is a constant cycling of material back and forth through the asthenosphere. Someday those atoms may end up at the same spreading ridge, or who knows, maybe another spreading ridge, and again, the light ones are going to be systematically separated out, and what you will get is basalt, which itself is formed by a partial melting process too, as a matter of fact, in the material of the mantle. The mantle is made of so-called ultra-basic or ultramafic rocks. When you partially melt those, you get basalt, and when you partially melt basalt, you get andesite. Question back there in the middle. Ah, good. What about Hawaii, the man says? Here is an example of something that is not a plate tectonic process per se. Okay? It is not, at least it's not related to anything that I've told you about so far. Consider what a spreading ridge is. It's a long linear plate in the Earth, which may extend over a good fraction of the circumference of the Earth, all along which material is melting down there in the asthenosphere, partially melting, and the basalt produced as a result is coming up to the surface. Isn't it strange this should happen along lines? Well, not at all. If it didn't happen along a line, suppose it happened in only a single place, then maybe you would have stuff coming up to the surface, but okay, there might be localized pushing of matter away from where it came to the surface, but nothing that is pushing an entire plate edge, right? By definition, the ones that are the plate edges are the ones that are the long lines. If they're not long lines, you're not going to make it. Since we don't know why this stuff comes up in the first place, except, well, here's a detail. We know, in general, where lava comes from. That is, remember how I told you that down there in the mantle, the rock is almost molten, but not quite, and if you release the pressure just a little bit, it would become molten? Apparently what happens is the pressure gets released just a little bit and it becomes molten. And when the rock is molten, any given rock when it's molten is lighter in density than the same rock when it's solid, and so it pushes its way up to the surface automatically as soon as you melt it. What we don't know, though, is what it is that manages to relieve the pressure in that way, you see? Okay, but suppose you have a place that is not a long line where matter is being melted and is making its way to the surface, but it's just a spot or a localized region. Then what you have in that place is a plume of material coming up from the mantle towards the surface. It is referred to, in fact, as a mantle plume. What happens when it reaches the surface? spreads out as volcanic material, right? Okay? And so, in the middle of the Pacific plate, it so happens there is a mantle plume, and material is coming up there and forming, in this particular case, basaltic volcanoes, not surprising, right? Generated by partial melting of the material down there in the mantle. And so you get basaltic volcanoes, which is what Hawaii is made of, not andesitic volcanoes, out in the middle of a plate. But you say, hold on, there are a whole bunch of volcanoes. Yes, there are. It appears, for reasons that we do not know, that mantle plume's activity is episodic. That is, a mantle plume will become active for a few million years, and then it'll stop being active for a few million years. And then it'll start acting up again for a few million years. And when I say for a few million years, I don't even mean continuously over that time. I mean every now and again during that period, you have a volcanic eruption. So, here's a mantle plume. Mantle plume stays where it is. It forms a nice basaltic volcano. Then it stops being active, and the plate moves over it. And then it gets active again, and it forms another volcano at a different place on the plate. And then it stops being active, and the plate moves over it. And then it forms another volcano, and another volcano, and so on down the line. So you get a line of basaltic volcanoes whose youngest member is in the direction that the plate is moving away from, and which gets excessively older as you go downstream. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is exactly what you observe when you go to the Hawaiian Islands and measure the ages of the basaltic rocks of which they are made. Furthermore, the orientation of that line, which is like this, is in exactly the direction the Pacific Plate takes, the motion that we already thought from other reasons the Pacific Plate was undergoing. The youngest one is at the east edge. And if you follow under sea, you find that in addition to the Hawaiian Islands that you see above the surface, there is a whole line of now undersea mountains, which have been reduced to by erosion to the point where you don't even see them above sea level anymore, called the Emperor Seamount Chain. The Emperor Seamount Chain bends and goes on up like that. Okay, so the whole thing goes like this. And it bends at exactly the place where the Pacific Plate should have been over the mantle plume, which is now over the easternmost, now under the easternmost Hawaiian island, at a time 70 million years ago when, from other evidence, we are quite certain the Pacific Plate changed its direction of motion. So it all works out. I'll give you another example of intraplate volcanism. The volcanism which, over the last 50 million years, has left a trail of lava over this part of the United States. There is the Columbia River Plateau of basalt, which is over in the entire eastern half of Washington and Oregon, floored with this basalt. The Grand Coulee is cut down into it. And that is the oldest part, because that's where the Pacific, that's the direction that the plate is moving away from. And then as you go east, you get successively younger and younger, cross the state line into Idaho, and all of a sudden it has a different name. It's called the Snake River Plain. And it's the same stuff. It gets younger and younger until you reach Craters of the Moon just west of Yellowstone, where there was active volcanism, basaltic volcanism, as recently as 2,000 years ago, and nobody would be in the least surprised if a volcano broke out there tomorrow. Or a little bit to the east, as the case may be. Because you know where that mantle plume is? And we have found the mantle plume and seen it by geophysical studies underneath Yellowstone National Park. There is a huge body of molten material down there under Yellowstone, which at the moment is quiet, although nobody would be surprised if a volcano broke out in the middle of Yellowstone tomorrow, or a little bit to the east. It's a big plume, so it could happen anywhere. And that is relatively quiet now, and the result is you have the final stage of volcanism there, hydrothermal activity. In the case of Yellowstone, you have the very rare variety of hydrothermal activity called geysers. What is normal for hydrothermal activity is hot springs and fumaroles, that is, places where gas comes up out of the ground. But that's what's going on in Yellowstone, and there is a good example of intraplate volcanism. Now, let me tell you something else. On Mars, there is a gigantic basaltic volcano, just like the Hawaiian Islands, except enormously bigger. It is the largest mountain that is known in the solar system. Its name is Olympus Mons, Mount Olympus, and it is a single volcano, a single mountain, 320 miles across, the size of the state of Arizona, one mountain. It's 15 miles high. On Mars, there is no plate tectonics. And so every time a mantle plume becomes active, its lava comes out on top of the same place. And so you build up these enormous volcanic piles. From Viking orbiter studies, it's estimated that Olympus Mons took at least 1 billion years to form, possibly more. During all that time, apparently Mars had a mantle plume, which was in the same place. Why is there no plate tectonics on Mars? Because a smaller planet cools off more efficiently than a larger planet. The heat inside a planet that keeps it hot is not left over or unchanged from the origin of the solar system. Geologists used to think that. They used to think the planets formed molten and they simply had a chance to cool. That's fine. You start doing the calculations, which we've only been able to do for the last 30 years or so, and it turns out the Earth has had time to cool down completely at least 300 times over in its history. So that's not primordial heat. No, the reason the Earth is hot inside is that there are very tiny quantities of radioactive materials in the rocks, trace amounts, not enough to make rocks dangerous, obviously, but enough to heat them up. Radioactivity produces heat. In fact, that's how it was originally discovered. Certain rocks insisted on sitting around being a fraction of a degree warmer than the air temperature in the room they were sitting in, and that is thermodynamically ridiculous unless they have some sort of energy source in there, and so they discovered radioactivity that way. Well, a given amount of rock doesn't have all that much radioactivity in it, and it doesn't generate all that much energy, but when that energy has no place to go but the surrounding rock, and it adds up over billions of years, it can be enough to keep the whole inside of a planet molten or nearly so. Okay? The amount of heat that is generated inside a planet is proportional to the number of radioactive atoms, and if two planets are made of the same kind of rocks, and by and large, Mars and the Earth probably are made of the same kind of rocks on the average, you know, mix it all together and you get the same kind of stuff, more or less, why then the amount of heat is proportional to the interior volume of the planet, right? Okay? How many cubic miles of rock there are in there? But how is the heat lost? The heat is lost into space only at the surface of the planet. And so the rate at which heat is lost into space is proportional to the surface area of the planet, which is to say the number of square miles out there at the surface. Now, take two different planets, Mars and the Earth, one of which is twice the size of the other. If the big one is twice the radius, twice the diameter of the other, that means that it has four times as much, not just twice, four times as much, two squared, as much surface area to lose heat into space. But it has eight times as much interior volume to generate heat in the first place. Okay? The interior volume goes up as you increase the size of the planet faster than the surface area. The volume goes up as the cube of the diameter, the surface area only as the square of the diameter. And so you expect a bigger planet or a bigger body of any sort to be hotter on the inside, to retain its heat more efficiently than a smaller body of the same nature. This is why cube ice in a given quantity, such as a pound, melts much more rapidly than a block of ice of the same amount of ice, right? Because you've got, break it down into smaller quantities, and you've got much more surface area, but the same amount of interior material to hold the heat. That is why there are no really small mammals in the Arctic. Small as you get are the snowshoe hares. You don't have any mice, you don't have any lemmings. Because the bigger the animal, if it's hot-blooded, if it's cold-blooded, whole different ballgame. But if it's hot-blooded, the bigger the animal, the more efficiently it holds its interior heat. Okay? And so this very simple physics explains everything from the nature of the animals that live in the Arctic of the Earth to whether or not planets have plate tectonics. If Mars is cooler on the inside, and if the reason that you have an asthenosphere on the Earth in the first place is that you're just at the ragged edge of being molten, then Mars is going to have a much, much cooler interior at a given depth, and it is therefore going to have a much thicker lithosphere. We don't know how thick its lithosphere is. Mars has not been obliging about giving us quakes so that we can study the interior structure of the planet during the time when we've had a seismometer on its surface. And so we know, as it turns out, a certain amount about the surface structure of Mars, but nothing about the deep interior. The Moon, however, has been very obliging. We had a whole set of seismometers on the Moon in active condition until they were turned off, would you believe, for lack of money on October 1st of last year. They're still working fine. And we have had a number of moonquakes and also natural meteorite impacts, in fact, more of the latter than the former, and a few artificial impacts as well, just to calibrate the whole thing. We know a lot about the structure of the moon, and I can tell you the moon, too, has a lithosphere, solid rigid rock, and then an asthenosphere, which in its case goes all the way or almost all the way to the center. The moon either has no iron core at all or only a very tiny one. It's all rock, or almost all rock. But the lithosphere is half of the radius of the moon. It is 500 miles in thickness. Well, I don't think it takes much imagination to realize that there is no way you are going to crack a 500-mile lithosphere into plates and expect one to dive down under the other, all right? And so, in fact, if a lithosphere is very much thicker than the Earth, you don't expect plate tectonics. And with that background, I can finally answer your question about the African plate. It turns out the African continent is the thickest continent on the Earth. It is so thick that a number of geologists believe that in the last few tens of millions of years, the African plate has become anchored. It is stuck to the mantle and it cannot move. And so the African plate is the one plate on this map where you don't see any arrows. Now that's cheating a little bit, because it turns out this map was made before that was known. And see, if you're talking about plate motions, you've got to say relative to what? Well, relative to mantle plumes would be an obvious suggestion, but this was before they were known, too. I mean, people realized, gee, there's something funny about Hawaii, but the mantle plume theory hadn't been worked out yet. And so what they did was they said, we can't plot absolute motions. All we can do is plot relative motions. We will arbitrarily pick a plate, pretend it's stationary, and talk about the motions of other things away from or towards it. And doggone, wouldn't you know it, the artist happened to pick the African plate for the purpose, which by sheer dumb luck was the right choice. Some plates are much more active than others. Antarctica, for example, has moved hardly at all over the last 200 million years, although before that it was quite active. There was a time when Antarctica was all the way up at the equator of the Earth, and you will find tropical coal swamps fossilized, buried under the ice cap in Antarctica. You will also find, from 500 million years ago, the remains, scratches, made by glaciers in the middle of what is now the Sahara Desert. At that time, the Sahara Desert was down near the South Pole. Africa was far from anchored then. I'm going to show you after the intermission, which is coming up very quickly, the history of plate tectonics on the Earth over the last 200 million years in some detail, although we're still working out lots and lots of loose ends, and then what we know about the history before that. But there is some evidence that what's been happening is that on the average, over geologic time for the last several billion years, the plates, at least the continental ones, have been getting thicker and thicker, and the sizes of them have been getting bigger and bigger. So there is evidence that, say, a billion years ago, there were a lot more plates, a lot more plate boundaries anyway, than there are now. And there's got to be some reason why there is the remnant of an ancient mountain range which may have once rivaled the Rockies or the Himalayas that formed in the northern part of Michigan 1.2 billion years ago. The chances are, it's hard to study because there's been so much erosion due to that liquid water on the Earth that so much of the evidence has been removed forever. But the chances are pretty good that once upon a time, the northern edge of Michigan was at the sea, was at the shore of an ocean, and two continents came together there and collided in the same way as India has collided with Asia. There is also extensive volcanism, basaltic and otherwise, accompanying that. There are the remnants of a great sheet of basalt, which once must have been like the 500,000 square miles that are covered by the Columbia River Plateau plus Snake River Plains. Remnant of that sheet in upper Michigan. Want to know what it is? That sheet has gotten buckled into a U-shaped trough over the intervening many, many years. And there are two places. The middle of that trough is deep down below the surface, and there are other rocks in it on top. But there are two places, two lines, where that trough comes to the surface of the Earth. That basalt happens to be unusually resistant to erosion, and those lines are unusually high. One of them is the Keweenaw Peninsula, and the other one is Isle Royale. A little more to it than that, because the Keweenaw also contains some sedimentary rocks, but it's that backbone of basalt, and so does Isle Royale, but it's that backbone of basalt that is sticking up on either side of the U-shaped trough. U-shaped trough is called a syncline, that is responsible for the presence of those features of our geography. If you stay with my Skylab tour of the United States series long enough, assuming I give them all, you will be able to go through the whole United States, bit by piece that way, and one after another, understand the reason for the geographic structures that you have been studying ever since you were a little kid. You will do that for the entire eastern United States 2 weeks from now, Skylab Tour Part 1. You'll know, for example, why Washington, D.C. is where it is and not somewhere else, just to take one out of many, many examples. So a couple of hands, I'm going to take those two questions, and then we'll have an intermission. Where were my hands? Okay, back there first. Oh, that was long, long before Pangaea. Pangaea was formed about 500 million years ago, stayed that way for 300 million years, and broke up 200 million years ago. We are talking about 1.2 billion years ago. During that period, well, I'll go through the history for you as much as we know it just after the intermission, but part of the story is that there had been an earlier Pangaea, which broke up 800 million years ago into separate continents, somewhat corresponding in outline to the continents that we know today, but there were details. For example, what is now Florida was then part of West Africa, and what is now Scotland was then part of, ironically enough, New England. It was then Old England. That came from North America. That Pangaea broke up, reassembled into the Pangaea that we now, the one I was talking about, and then that one broke up. It may happen again. There's some evidence it's been oscillating back and forth like a yo-yo. On a somewhat longer time scale, of course. Question here. Yeah. Can you speak a little louder? No, the Vermilion Range and the Porcupine Mountains and the Gogebic Mountains and all those other hills they got up there in the Upper Peninsula are the remnant of this great range of folded mountains, which I talked about, that formed, in fact, at about the same time, 1.2 billion years ago. You see, that was accompanied by volcanism. That particular mountain range is called the Pinocchian Range, and its formation is the Pinocchian Orogeny. Orogeny means mountain building by crumpling together. Pinocchian is P-E-N-O-K-E-A-N. It has nothing to do with Pinocchio. but it is pronounced the same way, and the name always startles people when they first hear it. What's that? Yeah, say? No, those are basalts. So you must have had some intraplate volcanism back then. Something that is hotly debated is, if you go back 2 or 3 billion years ago, was there anything like plate tectonics that we know now, or did you have entirely different processes going on, as you seem to on all the other planets? One thing we would very, 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 very much like to know is whether plate tectonics has to happen on any planet about the size of the Earth. The way I've talked up to this point, it sounds though it should, right? And I blame the lack of plate tectonics, which is not on Mars, is not on the Moon, is not on Mercury, is not on the Martian moons. We'll find out shortly about the Jovian moons, but everybody will be surprised if there is. I blame that simply on the fact that they're smaller and therefore have thicker lithospheres. Is it as simple as that, or is there more to it? Remember, we do not know the mechanism of plate tectonics. Well, the test case is Venus. Venus is the only other planet that is the same size as the Earth. We would very much like to know if there's plate tectonics there. As those of you see, the problem is Venus is totally covered by clouds, so it's a little bit difficult to find out to study its surface. The way you do it is by radar from the Earth with difficulty, or from an orbiting spacecraft much more easily. Well, at the moment, we just don't have enough data to be able to say, as those of you who attended the Venus lecture that was earlier in this series will recall. I suppose logically it would have been better to give this lecture first, but, you know, what the heck. There is evidence for it, fragmentary evidence for it. For example, there's a great trough that's been observed in radar observations from Earth, 800 miles long, that might be like the East African Rift Valley, or might be something else. There's a great trough on Mars, too, but it's not caused by plate tectonics. It was dug by the wind over a period of a billion years or so. Valles Marineris stretches a quarter of a way around the Martian equator. And it looks so much like the East African Rift Valley that some people really got excited when that was discovered by Mariner 9, and they thought, gee, maybe we're seeing plate tectonics there. No, we're not. On the other hand, on Venus, there are some gigantic basaltic mountains, not as high as those on Mars, because they can't be that high. Venus has a stronger gravity than Mars does, but apparently they go up to being as wide as those on Mars, and that, well, it's either evidence against plate tectonics, or it's evidence that in that particular place we happen to have an anchored plate. You know, it happens that there is no Olympus Mons in the middle of Africa, but if there were a nice big basaltic mantle plume there, you could have such a thing. We don't, as it happens, but, you know, you could imagine it. There is evidence, by no means definite, that Venus has in its rock much less water than Earth. And those of you who attended my Jupiter lecture will remember the reason for that, the reason we think that that's so. If so, Venus could be very much like the Earth, up to and including having the same temperature inside, and yet not be as close to melted as the Earth is through almost all of its interior, so that you have only that thin lithosphere that makes plate tectonics possible here. Why? Because the more water you have in the rock, the higher the melting temperature of the rock. Well, we are about to put a rather lousy radar, but it should be good enough for this kind of question, into orbit around Venus. Pioneer Venus Orbiter, which will be launched in less than a month, May 20th, and will arrive at Venus, and go into orbit around it, and map it with radar, among many other studies, most of which have to do with Venus's atmosphere, over the following at least 243 days. And hopefully we will be able to tell the answer to this very critical question, is there plate tectonics on Venus by those studies. But at the moment, it looks as though, aside from Venus anyway, we're perfectly safe in saying that plate tectonics does not occur on any other inner planet than Earth, and by planets I include moons as well, and that means that only Earth has mountains of the sort of the Appalachians and the Rockies and the Himalayas. I told you it's the weirdest planet of all. What are mountains on other planets then? Well, there are giant basaltic volcanoes such as Olympus Mons, and then there is another kind such as the mountains of the moon. The edges of gigantic craters, hundreds of miles in diameter, produced by titanic meteorite impacts, having the energy of hundreds of billions of Hiroshima-sized atomic bombs exploding simultaneously, all of which happened on the moon in excess of 3.5 billion years ago. A crater, which is dug by these enormous impacts, is not just a hole in the ground, it's a hole in the ground surrounded by a raised rim, which in fact is matter excavated out of the center of the crater by the sound wave of the explosion traveling through the ground with such enormous force that it can bulldoze tens of trillions of tons of rock hundreds of miles before it finally falls below the level of intensity where it can no longer bulldoze a solid rock. And that is what caused the mountain ranges on the moon, the so-called mountain ranges on the moon, which are of completely different origin than things like the Appalachians and the Himalayas. Okay, let's have an intermission at this point. It is now...
Best you've come across that mic all night.
All right.
Seems to turn down a bit.
Okay, let's run through the next few plates very quickly. These are extensions of details. This is a map showing the plate boundaries, not the motions on this one, but the plate boundaries, and the major volcanoes of Earth. And I think you will see the great majority of them are along plate boundaries. There are a few exceptions, such as Mauna Loa and Kilauea, which are in the Hawaiian Islands, and there are some that are not shown here. I wish they had shown the basalt plateaus as well. You find them here and there all over the Earth, and those basalt plateaus are the same sort of thing as the maria, the great dark areas of the moon. And in fact, you find plateau basalts, flood basalts, whatever you want to call them, on every planet in the inner solar system, and you do not find them in the Martian moons, which have not differentiated, differentiation being the term for this process of melting and stuff separating out. You don't find them in the Martian moons, but you find them everywhere else. Before we go any further, by the way, I want to tell you something that I forgot to mention before, but that's all right, because this will probably be of interest to the really devout ones anyway, and presumably those are the ones to stay for the second half. For those of you who are interested, I have here information sheets on the L5 Society, which is a pro-space exploration and particularly pro-space colonization group, which puts out it does political activity, and it also puts out a very, very excellent monthly newsletter called the L5 News, which will really keep you up to date on what's going on in space. And so if you are interested in any of that, here are these sheets, and you're welcome to take one if you are interested. I didn't want to just set them out there so people would take them, because some people would take them, then discover they're not interested in that particular thing and throw it out, and these are fairly expensive, and you know, I want to tell you what they were first. Here is some of the evidence for plate tectonics, which I promised you. The ages of the rocks on the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean are plotted here, where it says axis, that is that brownish-red line, is the center line of the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. You will note that it is cracked in various places and displaced. The reason for those things, which are called transform faults, is that the Earth is spherical, and if you are moving uniformly away from a ridge on a spherical planet, you quickly discover that the geometry messes you up. And it turns out that you can unmess this by cracking the ridge systematically here and there all along its length, and having different segments move out from different amounts of material move out from different places on the spreading ridge. So all of them have those transform faults. Well, what they've done is plotted ages, equal ages, as these bands of color, and I think you can see the youngest rocks they've shown here are 9 million years old, and those are fairly close to the axis. We've now had deep sea submersibles go right down into the crack itself, along the center of the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, and collect brand new basalt that had just come out of the inside of the Earth. And of course you can do that without getting your feet wet in one place, and that is Iceland, which is a place where so much basalt has come out that it's managed to get itself up above sea level. And the crack runs right down the middle of it, and so there is a place where the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, which is mostly underwater, comes up to the surface. Then as we move away from the ridge, we find older and older and older rocks until finally you get over to 180 million years there, just off the continental shelf, and similar kinds of ages just off the continental shelf on Africa, and it's perfectly symmetrical. Now what that shows is there has been spreading going along more or less uniformly over the last 200 million years, down to the resolution in time, down to the fineness that you can differentiate these ages in the kind of scale you're seeing there. But whether it's perfectly uniform over time scales of a year or a century or a million years, that we do not know the answer to. We have great hopes of finding it out, however, and that is by instruments which were left on the moon in the Apollo flight, starting with the very first landing, Apollo 11. Four sets of them all together, and also two of them delivered by the Lunokhod rovers, unmanned rovers sent up by the Russians. These are laser reflectors. You send a laser beam from the Earth to the Moon and bounce it back, and you can pick it up again when it gets back to the Earth. We know the speed of light very, very precisely, and we can measure the travel time very, very precisely. And as a result of this, you can measure the distance from the Earth to the Moon with an error of about 2.5 inches. Well, nobody cares exactly how many inches it is between the Earth and the Moon, except insofar as that number is changing and why. There are a bunch of reasons for doing this. For example, the Moon is moving away from the Earth very slowly. There are known reasons for that. They have to do with the fact the Moon causes tides in the oceans, and those tides cause friction, and that slows down the rotation of the Earth. The angular momentum has got to go somewhere, and it goes into the Moon, all kinds of complicated things about that. But we can calculate roughly how fast that ought to happen. And if the Moon is moving away a little faster than that, it may be because, as some gravitational theorists have suggested, gravity is steadily becoming weaker as the universe ages. Since it's gravity that holds the Moon into its orbit around the Earth, this would make the Moon move away from the Earth a little faster than you can account for by explanations like the tides. Somewhere around next year or within the next few years, the accumulated data should be enough to enable us to tell whether or not that is so. So by going to the Moon, we should be able to find out a major fact about the nature of the entire universe as a whole. Also, in just about the time scale, starting somewhere around next year, we should be able to measure, we should have precise enough observations that we can measure directly the motion of North America away from Europe. What you do is, North America cannot see Europe, and so you can't measure the distance from London to New York City by simply having one look at the other. They can't see each other. But both of them can see the Moon. So you measure the distance from New York to the Moon, you measure the distance from London to the Moon, you solve for the third side of the triangle, and you got it. You do it again 10 years later. Actually, of course, you do it many, many times through that entire 10 years. And of course, it's not New York and London, it's places where there are observatories, but that's the principle. And you should be able to see continental drift happening directly in a time scale of the order of 10 years. And next year, on July 20th, will be the 10th anniversary of the Apollo 11 landing on the Moon. So that should be coming in within the next few years. It was this evidence, the fact that, number one, ocean floor rocks are exclusively young, and number two, their ages go in stripes, symmetrically about the mid-ocean ridges and getting older systematically as you go away from the mid-ocean ridges, that came out in 1965 and which led to the sudden, dramatic, almost complete acceptance of plate tectonics which used to be called continental drift, and you see here seafloor spreading is the really significant ingredient by the scientific community. This is an excellent example of science in action. I have seen people who do not understand science and or are against it cite the long-time refusal of geologists, of most geologists, to accept continental drift, as they called it then, as an example of how scientists can be dogmatic and ignore evidence. And of course, the people that are doing this are trying to present, quote, evidence of about the level of validity of von Däniken's book. And you get it from that particular crowd, and they're trying desperately to show that scientists are dogmatic people and kick out anybody that's not in the club and so forth and so on. Well, this shows a complete lack of understanding of A, the way science works, and B, the history of the thing. Science works according to a number of principles, one of which is called Occam's razor, which is you assume things are as simple as possible until you are forced to believe otherwise. In other words, if you have two possible explanations, either of which could explain an observed fact, you pick the simple one until you get actual evidence that forces you to abandon that and go to the more complex one. This is not because we have any reason to assume the universe is necessarily simple or even comprehensible at all. It's because it turns out empirically that Occam's razor works and leads us sooner or later to the truth, whereas assuming that something more complicated than the evidence really allows you to assume turns out to get you into so many blind alleys that it's a real mess. Well, there simply was not sufficient evidence up until 1965 that continents really did move this way. And so, correctly, most geologists did not pay too much attention to the idea. All of a sudden, this new evidence came in. Note the source of it. The key to understanding the continents is exploring somewhere that isn't even on the continents at all, the bottoms of the oceans. All of a sudden, this new evidence came in, and right away, they all changed their minds. That is how science proceeds. I'll give you another example of that, an example which I'm deliberately picking because it turned out to be wrong. In the period that Thomas Jefferson, the only scientist who has ever been elected president of the United States, period before he was president, back when he was a scientist, there was a meteorite fall at Weston, Connecticut. At that time, most scientists did not believe that there was such a thing as a meteorite. Thomas Jefferson was told that two professors from Yale University had attested to the reliability of the report. And he said, and here's an excellent example of Occam's razor in action, "I would sooner believe the two Yankee professors would lie than that stones would fall from heaven." Absolutely correct scientific procedure. Take the simpler of the two hypotheses. Not too long after, there was an overwhelming fall, well documented, which this one wasn't, of meteorites at L'Aigle de France, and right away the scientific community changed its mind on meteorites because then there was firm evidence for their existence. If a UFO lands on the White House lawn and is well photographed and is taped by the inhabitant of the Oval Office and the tape is not erased, then I will believe in UFO. I can't take credit for that. It's a direct steal from Isaac Asimov. Here is how a new spreading ridge developed, illustrated by the way it actually happened when Pangaea broke up. And I think you can see there are two diagrams here. There is the continent. Here is, they keep insisting on labeling the lithospheric portion of the mantle as just the lithosphere, but you know the lithosphere is actually the whole thing. And there's the asthenosphere under it. All of a sudden, for whatever reason, the lava begins coming up along this long, long line across the Earth. And a few tens of millions of years later, here you have a young sea, the proto-Atlantic Ocean. You know, all those LL Airlines ads about the Atlantic River, all kinds of geophysicists have those hanging on their walls because they show the two continents almost touching one another. And LL's idea is our airlines make it so easy to get across the Atlantic that it might as well just be a river. But in fact, what do they know? They're drawing what the situation really was like just after Pangaea broke up. Here is a picture of a modern-day version of the same sort of thing, except not quite as simple because the direction of divergence is not perfectly parallel. This is a magnificent Skylab 4 photograph looking south over the Great Valley of California. There's the tip end of the Sierra Nevada, and there are the coast ranges. Here are the transverse ranges where the San Andreas Fault bends and moves around at an angle and then goes north again. And you can imagine how the rock just loves to be dragged around that bend. And that's why the Los Angeles area particularly is so seismically active. this gray stuff in there, that's the Los Angeles Basin, and that is the city of Los Angeles and its many suburbs. Pasadena right there, Jet Propulsion Laboratory right there. This, then looking south over the Gulf of California, where the spreading ridge either dives under the continent, if you believe that, or at least something comes on shore, and the Gulf of California, like this. Magnificent picture, which just happened to be taken at just the moment when the sun glint was right there on the Pacific. I love this picture. The transverse ranges actually continue offshore as the Channel Islands. Here is a picture a little bit further north, same sort of thing, again, Skylab 4 image. You're looking east over San Francisco Bay, and you can very, very clearly see the San Andreas Fault, like so, coming onshore and going offshore. It keeps doing that. That sand spit right there is where these turkeys built their village, right on the fault. This is Tomales Bay, which is, and there's Point Reyes National Seashore, and that's a place, Tomales Bay is the trace of the San Andreas Fault. See, it's a fault, and therefore the rocks are weakened along it, and so erosion has eaten it out there, and that's the reason you're able to see it. Try that one again. Okay, what I'm going to do now is show you a set of maps which follow the plate tectonics history of the Earth in fairly good detail for the last 200 million years. I got to warn you, not all the details on these maps are correct. In fact, there are some that we now are pretty sure are wrong. I guess it is shown here. Okay, I said that it was all together as a single supercontinent, Pangaea. This map is when it was just beginning to break up. And you'll notice the eastern part of Siberia is missing there. That was, in fact, probably a separate continent. And we now think that China was probably a separate continent then, too. And it came in and joined into Asia at a somewhat later time. And there are a lot of details that we don't understand. But basically, for example, exactly how do you fit Antarctica in with the rest, and where do you fit Australia into Antarctica? Antarctica is roughly circular in outline. Australia has that circular edge down there at the south, and you can fit it in almost anywhere. Now, some of the hints that you use are you trace particular rocks, particular strata of rocks across the boundary and see where they go across. Problem is, it so happens the outcrops are more or less parallel to that boundary and through there, and so it's hard to do that, and they're still fighting over that one. And you can see there are problems. Where do you fit Central America? Here they've solved the problem by simply ignoring it. And there are a few places, well, the worst overlap is there at Spain, and we now know the reason for that is that Spain has rotated somewhat during that period. It's moved downward somewhat. But basically and crudely, this is what Pangaea may have looked like. Now, this was 200 million years ago. That was 25 million years after the formation of the Appalachians, which separates the Paleozoic era from the Mesozoic era, which is the age of reptiles. You did not quite have dinosaurs yet. You had amphibians, and those amphibians tended to live in the equatorial region only because they are cold-blooded. When you started getting dinosaurs, all of a sudden you find them over a much larger latitude range, and that is part of the evidence for the recent contention of some paleontologists. This is quite controversial at the moment, that dinosaurs were in fact warm-blooded and not what we now think of as reptiles at all. And indeed, that there are still dinosaurs living, that they have evolved into the class of warm-blooded creatures, which we call birds. And there's a lot of evidence for and against this. You can read an excellent article about it should you be interested in the current issue of Science News, which is doubtless at your library, and it's the cover story, so you have no trouble finding it. The Great Dinosaur Debate is called. Or a few weeks ago, there was a good summary of it in Science Magazine, which is, this is one of their staff articles, not one of the professional papers, so it's at an easier level, and it's fairly easy to understand. Okay, this is another picture of about the same thing. You can see that there are details that are different from what I just showed you. Here the Central American problem has been solved somewhat more radically. But it's labeled Tethys C there. That's not the standard terminology. Tethys C is usually restricted to that part in there, the remnants of which are now the Mediterranean. But what this picture illustrates is that there was pretty much one continent, and also that means there was pretty much one ocean only. And that ocean is generally referred to as Panthalassa, which means all ocean, just the way Pangaea means all land. Panthalassa, therefore, had a much simpler system of ocean currents than does the present-day ocean. Now, you can follow all this in the paleontological record. You can find places where you have organisms, both animals, or you can find cases where two continents have different fossil records up to a certain point, and then all of a sudden it merges. Often there's a lot of extinction. No, not enough to explain the killing off the dinosaurs, which is still not understood, but often a lot of extinction. And then when the dust settles, you look again a few million years later, and both continents all of a sudden have the same fossil record, same kinds of animals and plants living there. What happened was the little beasties just hitched a ride on the raft of this moving continent, and when the continent plowed into another continent, they had to wait a few million years for the mountains that formed as a result of that to get eroded, and then they just, you know, gently stepped across, and there they were. Free ferry service provided by plate tectonics. Likewise, the faunal record and floral record in the oceans is in accord with this simple set of ocean currents. And there was, in fact, a good deal less diversity of animals and plants, much smaller number of species living on the Earth then than there is now. As a matter of fact, the greatest number of species that have ever lived in the history of life on the Earth is now, or more accurately, was just about 10,000 years or so ago in the Pleistocene, in the height of the last ice age, before our ancestors started killing them off. It's amazing how many people think that there's some mystic bond between primitive peoples and the ecosphere, and they understand about how you must be conservative and so forth and so on. Do you ever ask yourself why there are no more mammoths and saber-toothed tigers and all those good things? They survived all those ice ages and the warm periods in between. Then all of a sudden, the end of the last ice age, when suddenly humanity exploded across the Earth, it existed here and there in much smaller quantities earlier, but all of a sudden at the end of that, they get wiped out. Isn't that an interesting coincidence? It's also a controversial suggestion. I don't want you to think that it's universally accepted, but there is a good deal of evidence for it. And in fact, when the ancestors of the American Indian, who was often cited as someone who was mystically in harmony with the land, when the ancestors of the American Indians suddenly arrived over the land bridge during the last ice age between Asia, where they came from, and Alaska, where they entered the Western Hemisphere, all of a sudden, all kinds of large mammals disappeared in the fossil record. Okay, I don't blame them. They were hungry. And they didn't know about ecology, and that's the point. End of commercial. The first thing that happened was Pangaea split into a supercontinent in the north, which is called Laurasia, and a supercontinent in the south, which has already begun to split up in this drawing, called Gondwanaland. What each of these maps is going to do is show you in pink the new ocean floor that has developed as a result of sea floor spreading since the last map. All right? The intervals of the map are not even, however, so you got to pay attention to the dates. This is 180 million years ago, the end of the Triassic. We have already had lots of reptiles. The first true dinosaurs are about to appear. The Mesozoic era is divided into three periods. The Triassic is the oldest, the Jurassic, and then the Cretaceous is the youngest. It was ended by two dramatic events. Number one, the formation of the Rocky Mountains, and number two, the extinction of the dinosaurs and the ascendance of the mammals. That happened 65 million years ago. So here's the end of the Triassic. It was the latter two of those three periods, the Jurassic and the Cretaceous, where you had dinosaurs. Okay, Laurasia and Gondwanaland. Here it's just called Gondwana. The usual geologic nomenclature for it is Gondwanaland. It is named for a particular province in India where some of the key concepts were first dug out of the ground. Some of the key evidence was first dug out of the ground. So, if you know those names, you are now capable of understanding this bumper sticker.
See, I'll never guess why you're saying that.
Here we have the end of the Jurassic, 135 million years ago, 65 million years after our first map. It says there, after some 65 million years of drift, there had been drift before that. We know there's been plate tectonics for at least the last billion years or so, and before that, as I mentioned, it's controversial as to whether it happened at all, and if so, whether it was quite the same as we have today.
There's another speculation, I just wondered what you thought of it, that if you could hold the Earth still, that there was a large impact similar to the Imbrium-type impact that began all this. Stuff has been going back and forth like this.
There's just no evidence for it. What he's asking is a suggestion that there was a very large meteorite impact which broke up the continents and started them moving this way. We just don't know what happened. There's just not enough record of it left, unfortunately. Or I shouldn't say so much it's not left as it is buried under all that sedimentary rock, and so are the meteorite craters. And Precambrian geology, which is the name for the period that we really don't know, the first 7/8 of the Earth's history, the period up to 600 million years ago, is an active field, you know, and we know more this year than we did last year. But at the moment, I just haven't bothered talking about possible mechanisms for plate tectonics because they are all so speculative that the honest answer is we just don't know. Here is the end of the Cretaceous. A lot has happened since the last slide. For one thing, the dinosaurs have just died off. Not just the dinosaurs, but many other kinds of organisms, the ammonites, for example, which had been to the sea population what the dinosaurs had been to the land population. I should mention, by the way, that these maps show the continents, including continental shelves. They do not show areas of continental crust which have been temporarily inundated or even permanently inundated by seawater. And so if you look at other paleogeographic maps, you'll find North America doesn't look at all as much like the present-day North America as it does on these maps. And the reason for that is occasionally, roughly every 100 million years through the history of the Earth, the seas come up out of their beds and slop over the continents to form enormous areas of shallow sea, very much unlike the true oceans, which are deeper simply because they're formed by rock that is heavier. And it is those shallow seas which are the reason that most, not all, but most of the sedimentary rock in the interior regions of the continent, such as Michigan, is there. So there have been periods like that in the past. These I can talk about in a separate lecture that is really another whole lecture by itself. In fact, that would be Skylab Tour Part 2, or Earth, the Weirdest Planet Part 2. Suffice it to say that we are not discussing that here, nor is that shown on these maps. Finally, here is today. This pink is what has been produced. I'm going to go back and point out some specific details there. 65 million years ago, India was about halfway through its epic journey up through the Indian Ocean, and Australia had not yet broken off from Antarctica, and the Isthmus of Panama wasn't there. The ironic thing about the whole Panama Canal thing is that had we lived in virtually any other time in geologic history, it wouldn't have mattered. The Isthmus of Panama is a last-minute afterthought. We don't know, in fact, what produced it. And what happened is, all of a sudden, only about, I think it was 9 million years ago, that section of continent decided to come up above the floor, above sea level. Before that, it had been drowned. Same thing is true of Florida. Florida has been mostly inundated by the sea throughout the past of geologic history, ever since it was broken off from Western Africa, when Pangaea split up. For most of that period, Florida has been just barely underwater. Indeed, if you look at a map, a contour map of the seafloors around Florida, you will find that two-thirds of Florida is still underwater. And the part that we think of as Florida is just the highest part of a gently curved section of continental rock, most of which is now under sea level. That's called the Florida Arch. The Yucatan Peninsula is a very similar structure over on the other side, so to speak, though there's no evidence they're actually part of the same structure. And, you know, Florida, all of it is just barely above sea level as it is. And you had tremendous changes in the area of Florida as a result of relatively small sea level changes during the ice ages particularly. Much more of it was out of water then than now. Just incredible how flat, how low most of Florida is. The highest point in the whole state is something like 200 feet, and that's on the Georgia border. And in Everglades National Park, the highest point in the entire park has a magnificent elevation of an entire 4 feet above sea level. Differences in inches of altitude lead to completely different ecological communities in Everglades.
You mentioned 30 hurricanes across Florida, and the entire south area was completely washed.
Really? Okay, this is a man who lives in Florida, and he tells me during the 1930 hurricanes, the whole of Dade County was awash. Has anybody told Anita Bryant about this? Here is today. I draw your attention to the fact that the Atlantic Ocean is getting wider. This is the amount of new seafloor that has appeared during the entire age of mammals, the entire last 65 million years, and India has now slammed into Asia, and Australia is still moving northward. Now, the next map is much more speculative. It is a map of what the world will look like 50 million years from now if, and this is a very big if the plate tectonics motions continue the same directions and the same speed as they are right now. And the one thing you can be almost certain of is that's not going to happen. But it's, of course, the only way in our present state of ignorance about what causes them that you can do this. So let us look at this map 50 million years from now, and really what it's good for is to teach you what plate tectonics motions are happening now, see by exaggerating them to the point where you can see their effects. You'll note that Australia has moved quite a distance. The present-day positions of the continents are shown in gray here, so you can trace what's happened. And Australia will have moved almost up to the equator and begun to push Indonesia into eastern Asia. The eastern part of Africa is beginning to split off, and the Americas have continued to move away from the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. One thing that I think is very unlikely is that the Mediterranean Sea is shown there as open, though you notice Italy has gotten shoved around quite a bit. Incidentally, in this map, you will note that Africa is shown as having moved. As I told you, that's probably wrong. But the Mediterranean has undergone a very dramatic history, which we have worked out only after this map was printed just a few years ago. You understand, the plate tectonics, after it was first generally accepted by the geologic community only 12 years ago, has been undergoing constant revolutions ever since, and we're still working out many, many details of these histories, and it's just getting a more and more fascinating story as time goes on. But one of the things that we discovered from one of the great scientific research endeavors of our time, the Deep Sea Drilling Project, where the ship, the Glomar Challenger, is going all over the Earth, taking cores in the oceans to study plate tectonics, to study sedimentation, to study all kinds of things, and filling in many of these details for us, and learning what's been going on, at least for the last 200 million years, where we've still got record of the seafloor. Before that, we have no idea what the seafloor was doing. You know, all of the plates that existed before that are gone. And so a gentleman asked before the intermission, does it ever happen that a C4 plate is destroyed? The answer is it always happens that a C4 plate is destroyed within just a few hundred million years of its creation. But what happened was this. The relative motion is that either Africa is moving north, as shown here, towards Europe, or Europe is moving down towards Africa. And either way, the Tethys Sea is closing up. There is an example of an ocean moving towards the final stages of destruction. And one of the things the Glomar Challenger discovered is the beginnings of the new mountain range on the floor of the Mediterranean Sea that is being created as a result of this. Those mountains will be above sea level before too long.
The floor of that sea, is that the continental?
The floor of that sea is oceanic. This is not a shallow sea on the surface of the continent, such as they were talking about before. We have almost none of that kind of thing today. This happens not to be one of the periods when that happens. And you must understand the Mediterranean Sea is not an epicontinental sea, which is the name for that. Epi means upon, so epicontinental, upon the continents. The Mediterranean is a true ocean with a deep basin, and it is just closing up. That'll get shoved up, yes. What happened is that 9 million years ago, Africa slammed into Europe and closed the Straits of Gibraltar. And then apparently bounced, moved south, and has now turned around, and the relative motion is now northward again. More likely, I should be saying that it was Europe that was doing the moving and not Africa. Well, the Mediterranean Sea is at a latitude such that it is semi-arid there if there is not a source of seawater from someplace. And as you know, the greatest desert on the Earth is just south of that, although in fact that desert is only partly due to the latitude. The Sahara Desert was created also by very primitive technologies, goat herding and sheep herding. And that's the greatest ecological disaster that's happened since the Pleistocene, and again, that was not produced by the evils of modern technology. The Sahara, however, would be there, although considerably smaller, and there's a desert belt around those latitudes of the Earth for meteorological reasons that are too long a story to go into. Well, the point is, the only reason there's water in the Mediterranean is that it keeps flowing in from the Atlantic through the Straits of Gibraltar. And if you close off that flow, the Mediterranean will dry up completely in only a few thousand years. 9 million years ago, that happened. The entire Mediterranean Sea, 15% of the ocean surface of the Earth, dried up. What that produced was a drastic climate change, of course, in Europe and Northern Africa. And the paleontologists had known that almost since the science was founded and hadn't known what caused it. It's the boundary between the Pliocene, which was the epoch that preceded the Ice Age, the Pleistocene, and the one before that, the Miocene. And they knew there was a boundary because all of a sudden there's a big fossil change. Nobody knew why. In fact, it produced a major change all over the Earth. 15% of the water of the Earth evaporated, leaving its salt behind. That was how the Glomar Challenger discovered the fact the Mediterranean dried up. They drilled into the salt beds, thousands of feet in thickness, many of which, of course, got eaten away again as soon as the water came back in, but some of which were preserved by sediment that got laid down on top. That explained a whole bunch of things that had never been understood. For example, the Nile River and a number of the rivers around the Mediterranean basin have under them deep channels, hundreds, even thousands of feet below sea level, eaten into the bedrock, now filled with sediments under the rivers. But a river cannot eat a channel, cannot flow below the sea level that it's flowing into. So how could they have done this? Well, you've got a picture, something like the Nile or the major rivers of Europe, flowing out of the interior of the continent, going over the edge, and then evaporating. It must have been a true hellhole. It must have been like nothing that is on the Earth today. The Dead Sea is very hot and very dry and very saline. It is only a few hundred feet below sea level. This, as I just told you, is a deep ocean basin. It was as much as 2 miles below sea level, and suddenly that became dry. It's estimated the temperatures down there reached above the boiling point of water. This is Earth, not Venus. That lasted. Oh, and it affected all over the Earth because that evaporated water left the salt behind, but of course the water itself went through the atmosphere and rained into the seas elsewhere. And what this means is that the salinity of all the Earth's oceans was measurably decreased. And that led to faunal changes and floral changes all over the Earth. It lasted for 2 million years, and then the Straits of Gibraltar opened again as a result of the motion turning around and going the other way. A waterfall developed at the west end of the Mediterranean Sea, 2 miles high, and the entire width of the Strait of Gibraltar, ultimately, or most of it. And over that waterfall, flooded in the waters of the Atlantic and filled up the basin again in something of the order of a few tens of thousands of years. That, of course, led to another major faunal change. The two sort of blur together in the fossil record, only a 2 million year period, so the two of them together constitute the boundary, and you got to draw the exact boundary arbitrarily in there somewhere between the Miocene and the Pliocene. And that is certainly one of the most dramatic stories in Earth geology. It was only worked out a few years ago by the Glomar Challenger exploration. We have salt beds under Michigan, which were formed by a somewhat similar process back in the Silurian era. Much less dramatic, though, because it was not a true ocean that dried up there, merely an epicontinental sea. But even so, there is a total thickness of Silurian salt under Michigan. You know, they mine it under Detroit and in other places. Total thickness of Silurian salt. It happened repeatedly. The sea would come in, dry up, come in, dry up, come in, dry up, in response to slight fluctuations in sea level here and there. Michigan at the time was around the equator. So again, it was an arid region. And total thickness of Silurian salt in Michigan of 2,000 feet. There's a single bed that is 500 feet thick. But that was nothing compared to the drying up of the Mediterranean. Well, the point is that the relative motion is now again that Europe is moving south or Africa is moving north, whichever way you want to look at it. And so it is unlikely that 50 million years from now there will be a Mediterranean Sea. Again, we will have the same sort of dramatic process, and again we will have the same sort of hellish basin 2 miles deep down there on the floor. And Africa will continue moving, perhaps, and eventually you'll have a mountain range there. You understand, the final stage in the evolution of an ocean is that it turns into a mountain range. Question, did I see a hand? Right. That's it. Eventually it'll turn into a mountain range. You'd have layers of salt in the mountains, but you got to remember rock salt is not a chemically stable stuff in an environment where there's so much water, and it's difficult to generate it. As a matter of fact, a lot of that Silurian salt has gotten eaten away after sedimentary rocks in some thickness, hundreds of feet in thickness, got put down on top of it, which means that all of a sudden they collapsed into the resulting holes. And that, of course, weakened them tremendously, which meant there was a lot of erosion there, first by rivers and then by the glaciers. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is why the Straits of Mackinac are where they are. That is a place where that weakened, collapsed rock happens to come to the surface and thereby is eroded away at the surface. And so that's a low area. And the weakened, collapsed rock is referred to as the Mackinac Breccia. And you can go see it on the north side of the bridge. There's a nice exposure of it in a road cut. But I'm giving away too much of my geologic history of Michigan lecture here. Let's continue. Before 200 million years ago, we don't know the details very well, and so what we're going to do here is give you some, as you see, highly schematic diagrams, which give you an idea of roughly what it was like. 800 million years ago, as I said, there was an earlier Pangaea, and that itself seems to be the result of the coming together of yet earlier separate continents. And by that time, you go back through enough changes that it is difficult to keep track of what those continents were. They don't correspond too well to modern geography. I gave you an example of one that was still earlier than that, where there seems to have been an ocean between what is now Upper Michigan and Canada. And those came together and formed the Pinocchian Range. So, you know, just what you're going to call these continents is going to be a little bit difficult. Well, the first thing that happened was that 800 million years ago, towards the close of the Precambrian, that split into something we can call North America, but it differed from it in detail. It didn't have, it did have Scotland then, it did not have Florida then, and so forth. Something we can call Europe, and that was a separate continent then with an ocean between them, from a continent that we can call Asia, and in the south, a continent which, again, we can call Gondwanaland, though it was not the same in detail as the later ones. Those split up and recombined in a complex fashion in which, number one, Europe slammed into Asia, thereby closing up the original Atlantic Ocean, the Atlantic Ocean before the present one, and producing a mountain range which is the ancestor of the present-day Appalachians. Remember I told you there's a tendency for mountain ranges to keep occurring and then being destroyed by erosion at the same edges of continents, and of course you know the reason for that. Edges of continents is where the action is, right? That's where, whenever you have subduction, you're going to be having the crumpling. That particular event is referred to, we used to think it was two separate things, and so the historical geology textbooks have two different names for it. In fact, it was a long continuing process because the two continents didn't collide head on. They came together sort of like closing a zipper. And it took hundreds of millions of years for it to happen. So when I give you these numbers, they're approximate. And that is referred to as the Acadian orogeny in the north and the Taconic orogeny in the south. Confusingly named, the Taconic orogeny and the Taconic mountains it produced are named for the present-day Taconic mountains, which are not remnants of that orogeny. Okay? They were named because some of the field work that led to our understanding that this happened was done then. Those mountains were totally eroded down to sea level within a few hundred million years, and then later on the Appalachians formed, and you'll learn more about that story next week. Well, the sea between Europe and Asia still existed. The next thing that happened was Asia began to come back together, and we formed, as a result of this, our Pangaea, so to speak, the Pangaea that most recently broke up. Here is that Pangaea, and then the remainder of the story you have already seen in greater detail in those previous diagrams. That's it. Can we have the lights, please? I should say, to be continued, because what I'm going to do next week is tell you the history of the Appalachian Mountains. In fact, I'll tell you what, since it is only 10:15, a ridiculously early time to stop, let me tell you a little bit about the history of both the Appalachians and the Rockies, just to give you an idea of how the interaction occurs on this weirdest planet of all between two processes which happen only on the Earth, so far as we know, plate tectonics which builds mountains, and water erosion, which destroys them. Let's talk about the Appalachians first. The Appalachians, and I mean our present Appalachians, not their ancestors, the Acadian Taconic ranges, first formed 25 million years ago. And if you've been paying attention, you may have noticed that that was during the time that Pangaea existed. They formed in the middle of Pangaea. Isn't that strange? Well, what happened was an even more extreme, apparently, was an even more extreme example of what is going on now as India is still trying to move up into Asia and forming the Himalayas as a result. What apparently happened was the continents came together, thereby forming the Akkadian and Taconic ranges, and those got eroded away. And then, 225 million years ago, for some reason, the motion that brought those continents together reactivated itself. Europe and Africa made one last attempt to push into America. And it didn't work, but it crumpled up the land in the middle. And so there you have the strange situation of the creation of a folded mountain range by plate tectonics in the middle of a continent. Now, those Appalachians formed 225 million years ago. They consisted of a towering, snow-clad range of peaks marching unbroken from Scandinavia down through the British Isles, Newfoundland, the entire eastern part of the United States into Georgia. At Georgia, they turned west and went across the northern tier of the northern part of the Gulf Coast tier of states, down through Oklahoma and Texas, and into Mexico. Within just a few tens of millions of years, that entire range was gone, eroded down to sea level by the erosion which began as soon as the uplift started to occur. And that would be the end of the story were it not for another process which is very, very poorly understood and which may not be related to plate tectonics at all. It's called epirogeny. Remember, orogeny is folded mountain build, crumpling of the crust. Epirogeny, or more often epirogenic uplift, or epirogenic downwarp, is different from orogeny like this. We could model orogeny by taking a rug, letting it represent a piece of the Earth's crust, and you get it one side, and I get it the other side, and we push the two edges towards one another. The rug will crumple, right, and form some folded mountain ranges. In fact, in the real Earth case, if you push it violently enough, it doesn't just crumple, it breaks. It forms a series of fault blocks, which thrust up into the air. And as we will see next time, the Appalachians show crumpling primarily and folding in the northern half of what is left of them, and faulting in the southern half. And we don't really know the reason for the distinction there, but apparently it was a little bit more violent in the south. And the rock didn't have time to deform plastically and fold, so it faulted and broke. Epirogeny would be as though we had a scale model of some terrain, high or low, mountainous, not mountainous, whatever, on a card table, and you and I took hold of opposite edges of the card table and gently and non-destructively lifted it up into the air. Large sections of the Earth's crust can have this happen to them. They can also get downwarped. In fact, Michigan is an excellent example of a case where there was a large-scale downwarp, a pyrogenic downwarp, for hundreds of millions of years from about 600 million years ago through about 300 million years ago. And so we were almost always flooded with epicontinental seas, even when other parts of the continent were not. And that's called the Michigan Basin, the structure that was produced as a result of that. And those are the rocks that are under all the glacial drift here. Well, a pyrogenic upwarp, that's what caused things like the Ozarks, too, see? I told you it was an uplifted plateau, right? But I didn't tell you what it uplifted. Epirogenic. Epirogenic. It comes from the Greek word epiros, meaning mainland, but it's used here in the sense of continent. Okay? So epirogenic means literally continent forming, but don't pay too much attention to derivations of scientific words. Photography does not mean writing with light. Hippopotamus does not mean river horse, and so forth. No, not in this lecture. Sorry. Can't do everything. I'll tell you, though. I can say this about it. The Canadian Shield is an example of really extreme epirogenic uplift over a period of at least the last 800 million years that has been above sea level the entire time. And every one of the continents has a shield area like that. And you see, those are very old rocks. One, because sediments don't get weighed down on top of them since they're above sea level. And number two, because erosion is happening there because they're above sea level and eating down into the older, i.e. lower rocks. So, okay, so I can certainly say that much about the Canadian Shield and the other shields.
How would you count for the Tokyo Bay, where the bottom of the ocean fell something like 2,000 feet in the 19th century?
2,000 feet?
Right.
Over what area?
In the Tokyo Bay.
In Tokyo Bay?
Former Tokyo Bay.
Okay, I know zero about detailed Japanese geology. I just never heard about this. I have no idea. But see, you're talking about a local thing. I mean, I admit, if that's what happened, it was very spectacular, but it's also local, you know. And well, I gave an example and promised to tell you the reason for it of something local, which is not caused by plate tectonics, and that was the great New Madrid, Missouri earthquake. All right? The greatest one that's ever happened in the United States in recorded history. And we'll get to that very shortly. All right, so what happened was the Appalachians were eroded completely down to sea level just a few tens of millions of years after they formed. Then the whole eastern part of the United States was uplifted 2 miles. And erosion ate down into the different rocks and began to lay bare the roots of the Appalachians, thereby producing a new mountain range. And that was eroded much of the way back down to sea level, when again there was a pyrogenic uplift, again you had a new mountain range formed, and that is now in the process of being eroded back down towards sea level again. The Appalachians were much far higher than they are now, but that is all gone. Those peaks, which were originally 20,000 feet above sea level, have now been eroded away, new rock uplifted from underneath to replace them, and the rock that we see in the Appalachians today is rock, or at least includes rock, which in the original Appalachian orogeny 225 million years ago was miles under the surface of the earth. The Appalachians that we see today are the eroded remnants of roots of an original folded mountain range. They are not the things that were produced in the Appalachian orogeny themselves. Let me go on just a little bit further, and it might very well answer it. Because there's something I don't want to lose track of here. Epirogeny, whatever causes it, does not seem to pay a whole lot of attention to what else exists in the part of the country that gets uplifted or downwarped. The region that was uplifted in each of these was by no means identical to the region that had been turned into mountains by the orogeny. And so we've got places here where the Appalachians were entirely eroded down, and then some parts of that were uplifted. Other parts were actually downwarped. The parts that got uplifted are the present-day Appalachians. But there was a very dramatic downwarp. About 50 million years ago, the whole continent of North America bent gently in the middle, forming a bay, a trough, down the middle of the continent, which originally was full of water, of seawater, but of course, since it was downhill to all directions, that attracted a whole new set of river systems, which began busily filling in that embayment with sediment, eroded off the Appalachians to the east, and eroded off the Rockies, which by now had formed to the west. That's called the Mississippi Downwarp. And so slowly, the greatest river on the continent began to form down the middle of that trough, and carry sediment, and all the tributaries, all the other rivers flowing in from the side carried sediment. The Mississippi downwarp filled in with sedimentary rocks, burying the portions of the Appalachians' roots that had gone across that section under miles of sediment. And that is why you do not see mountains today marching across northern Mississippi, northern Alabama. They are there. Their roots are there. They even get up into Kansas. There are mountains in Kansas, but they are buried underneath these miles of sediment. You could make out a case for the statement that the Mississippi Delta extends from the southern tip of Illinois all the way down to Louisiana. That has filled in by sediments deposited by the Mississippi, and what is that but a delta, right, during the last 50 million years or so. Now, those sediments are very, very heavy, and every once in a while they settle. New Madrid is right at the north tip of the Mississippi embayment. It's the settling of those sediments which produce the great New Madrid earthquake. So you see, there's an example of a local effect, and yet one that was very violent. Oh, there's going to be another New Madrid earthquake, no question about it. Maybe not as violent, but that's a seismic area. Sure, that sediment is still settling, bit by piece. Say again?
The
yeah. Not necessarily. On the average, the amount of material that is uplifted must equal the amount of material that is downwarped. Or else, every time you uplift 1 square mile, you got it, 1 mile, you got it downwarp a half square mile, 2 miles, or something of that sort. Otherwise, you end up with continents supported up in the air somewhere, and that's not going to happen. Certainly, but the eroded material is deposited elsewhere as sediment. It's going to get deposited over the continental shelves if nowhere else. No. No. At least I can't think of any cases where that's happened. No, the general rule is the higher up you are, the more you're being eroded. The lower down you are, the more there is deposition. And so what's happening is erosion is trying to turn the continents into level plains at sea level, and plate tectonics and epirogeny together keep thwarting that activity by raising up new mountains and new plateaus. Okay? And there is this balance between the two of them, and that is something that happens. None of that happens on any other planet that we know. Epirogeny and orogeny, the way I've been describing them, occur only on the continents, yes. Yes.
What kind of ages do they come up with on these roots of the Appalachians?
What kind of ages do you get in the roots of the Appalachians?
Yeah.
For the most part, early Paleozoic. You get back into late Precambrian in some of them. But you got to realize, well, when I talk about the history of the Appalachians next time, it'll be, you know, there'll be more detail on that. You got to realize that the orogeny itself was accompanied by a lot of metamorphism, that is changing of rocks, and that resets the radioactive clocks, changes their ages, and also by a lot of volcanism, you know. In addition, the sediments kept getting deposited all around, and then a lot of those sediments got eroded up, got uplifted as well, and so major parts of the Appalachians, as you will see next week, are sediments eroded from other parts of the Appalachians, and then themselves later uplifted. So it gets very complicated very fast. But let me, well, okay.
I know you don't want to indulge in speculation.
Right.
Could you tell us what the general lines of inquiry are and what things people are investigating at the cause of President's crisis?
Just too long. It's just too long and... I mean, we don't know. That's the point. Okay, that'd be almost another whole lecture itself. I'm not at all sure I'm even competent to do it because I haven't even bothered to keep track of it. You know, what I know is that we don't know. And I'm not a geologist. I look at the Earth as a special case. I try to keep track of its major features and don't worry about the fine details. A practicing geologist, of course, would have to do that. Okay, I think you were first. Yes.
Don't the most people start going back up here?
Yes.
And take that material with
us? Yes.
Are we losing material with the past?
No. In fact, if anything, it may be the other way around. The continents seem to be growing at the expense of oceanic material. For one thing, we probably accrete more as a result of andesitic volcanism than we lose by the process you're talking about, where sediments from the continents are subducted. For another thing, those sediments from the continents tend to be very lightweight materials. It turns out, when you erode rocks, not all of the minerals get incorporated into the sediments that are deposited by a river, by the rivers as a result. Some are destroyed entirely. They're dissolved, they're carried away in that way, they become part of the salts in the sea. And it turns out the ones that survive systematically tend to be ones that are unusually light, which means that they are unusually likely to get back up to the surface again as a result of partial melting. So, in fact, there is evidence that the continents have been growing, this is very controversial also, but there is a good deal of evidence the continents have been growing steadily from small centers in the shield regions, originally fairly small centers, and certainly there are some cases where that has definitely happened, California being an outstanding example. California is a relatively recent addition to the North American continent. It is new continental material that has been produced relatively recently out of originally oceanic material. And you won't find any rocks in California that are older than early Mesozoic. Except up in the very far north. I mean, California, of course, is an arbitrary geographic region, you know. But most of California is the sort of thing that I've been talking about. Okay, you were next.
Wouldn't you say the core of the Earth is cooled because of the reduced radioactivity?
Okay, please do me a favor. Don't say core when you mean interior. Core is a technical term. It means that big iron thing down there. We do not know if the interior of the Earth is cooling or is heating up. You could argue either way. It's a matter of the balance between production and loss of radioactivity, and there are things like thermal inertia and so forth. We just do not know the answer, nor do we know it for any other planets. There are people who think that Mars is a planet that is just beginning to wake up, that someday it may get hotter, someday it may have plate tectonics. There are others who think that it's cooling down, that all its geologic activity was in the distant past. We don't know. Okay, so the moon, we know. Lots of geologic activity, although none of it plate tectonics. In the first billion years of the moon's history, almost none since. Virtually none. The moon is not totally dead geologically, but it's very, very quiescent. There are moonquakes, true ones, not just meteorite impacts, but the total amount of seismic energy released inside the moon by those moonquakes during a given time period, such as a year, is about a trillion as much as the amount of seismic energy released inside the Earth during the same time period. And there are gentle eruptions of gas from inside the moon from time to time. But it's certainly very dead compared to the Earth. Grant, you were next. Can't hear you. Geosynclines I'm going to talk about next week, okay? So let me put that one off. Sorry about that. How did the ocean get formed? Well, you mean where did the water come from? Outgassing. As to how it got to be the salt, that's material partly washed down from the continents by rivers, and partly, in fact, material that originates chemically as a result of the new basalt coming up at the spreading ridges. So it's not all a matter of the salt of the ocean comes from the continents. Where did what originally come from? The ocean? I say the water was produced by outgassing. Outgassing. Yeah.
I wondered if you would be able to go to the two formations of granite.
No. Well, really, that's another. It's not next week. It's not in any of these of this lecture series. It's just got to be a totally different thing. In fact, I talked about the Venus lecture, I believe. Let me tell you about the Rockies, which have a somewhat similar history with a bit different detail. They were uplifted 65 million years ago. I'm sorry. Their orogeny was 65 million years ago. And again, erosion began to try to reduce them to sea level, but here there was a big difference. That was in an arid region of the Earth, at least semi-arid. And so the rivers were not able to make it all the way to, well, most of them flow to the east, all the way to the Mississippi until relatively recently. And what the rivers tended to do was go as far as they could, evaporate, and leave their sediments behind. And so within a few tens of millions of years after they formed, the Rockies became buried in their own eroded debris and remained that way through almost the entire period since they formed. Most of the age of mammals, if you could have gone to where now the Rockies, you would have stood in what is now empty air, maybe several miles above where the surface is now, and you would have stood on a flat plain such as that which is now over the bits of the Appalachians in Kansas and had no idea that there were buried mountains under you. Only a few of the highest peaks stood up above this. Oh, I'm sorry, I forgot we had a flurry of questions and I got cut off in the middle of the Appalachians. There's one, or toward the end of the Appalachians. One final little bit, and that is if you go over on the other side of the Mississippi River, there is a place where the Appalachians come up again above the sediments and then dive back down. That place is the range of mountains called the Ouachita Mountains, which someone asked about quite some time ago. And for some reason, most Americans seem never to have heard of them. They're there, they're right south of the Ozarks, the so-called Ozark Mountains. These are true mountains. The Ozarks are a plateau produced by a pyrogenic uplift. But, okay, so getting back to the Rockies, 9 million years ago, there was a pyrogenic uplift over almost the entire western United States, including not only the mountain areas, but large regions of epicontinental sea and other sediments. And those areas, the flat-lying sediments that got uplifted, are what is now called the Colorado Plateau. That started out near sea level. There was a river, a rather sluggish river, flowing across it, the Colorado. As the uplift proceeded, the Colorado simply stayed where it was and ate down through the layers of rock like a bandsaw. And that is the origin of the Grand Canyon. By now, that has gone so far that the Colorado